Today's episode of the KingCast is brought to you by The Order of the Malachi by John Grossi. In 12th century Germany, the medieval village of Arnost is plagued by an outbreak of vampirism. The Catholic Church sends in their slayers, the Malachi, the young Kale, Legrand, a French aristocrat, and Dennis, an aging German knight. As the Malachi hunt the undead, they trace their origins of the Lord of the Wood, an ancient vampire worshipped by a local witch cult. This leads to a torchlit duel between Legrand and the Lord of the Wood. The Malachi are then drafted into the Crusader army of Frederick Barbarossa of Germany. During the long march to the Holy Land, the Malachi learn of the Reign of Terror by the Impaler of Carpathia, a former prince and now powerful vampire. Legrand and Kale desert the army and ride north to the dark mountains of Carpathia. The Order of the Malachi is now available on Amazon Kindle and Apple Books. For a free excerpt, check www.orderofthemalachi.com.
And I'm here to tell you a little bit about our corporate overlords at Fangoria. It is time for the Fangoria read. Everybody get excited. Fangoria has been at it for over 40 years, and it is better than ever. The magazine is not only gorgeous, it's highly collectible, and is delivered right to your front door 4 times a year. Each issue is filled to the brim with articles exploring every nook and cranny of genre filmmaking, past, present, and future, with all the most exciting journalists, filmmakers, and horror know-it-alls to guide the way, including your intrepid KingCast host. This high-quality writing will only ever appear within the physical pages of the magazine, so if you want to join in on the fun, you'll need to subscribe. And to do that, all you got to do is head on over to Fangoria.com and sign up. If you use the code KingCast at checkout, you will save a whopping, astronomical, massive, gargantuan 25% off of your subscription.
Now on with the show.
Hi. My name is Stephen King.
The ice is gonna break!
Bad rum!
You guys wanna go see a dead body?
Sometimes that is better.
Hello and welcome back to the KingCast on the Fangoria Podcast Network. My name's Scott Wampler.
And I'm Eric Vespi.
And we are your hosts. Our guest today is a KingCast first timer, and we're delighted to have him here speaking with us. He's the director behind 2018's The Domestics, 2021's excellent Wrong Turn, which Patton Oswalt recommended to us when he was on the show. That's why I initially saw it. And the man behind the best segment, segments in last year's VHS 85. He's here today to talk about one of our preferred Stephen King creature features, 1990's Graveyard Shift, starring Brad Dourif and a bunch of giant rats. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Mike P. Nelson to the KingCast stage. How are you doing today, Mike?
Hey, guys. Thanks for having me on. This is kind of pinching myself here that I'm actually on this thing with you guys.
Oh,
oh no! Nice.
Well, very nice.
Yeah, very, very kind of you. We're happy to have you here. I think we crossed paths at Fantastic Fest last year, and
talked about
getting you on the show, and it took a little while longer than I think either one of us anticipated. But I'm glad you're finally here, so I can further proselytize about Wrong Turn to your face. Well, not to your face, but to your ears anyway.
Nice.
That was a franchise that I had just written off, you know? Like, I saw the first one and didn't like the second one, and then I think I... Wasn't there a third one?
Oh, at least. Yeah.
Yeah, there is a lot of them. I believe ours is technically the seventh.
Holy shit, really?
They're vying for the Corn Boys title of the,
yeah.
the most sequels / reboots. Yeah,
I had no idea that there were that many. Well, how did it come to pass that you made one of the good ones? Like, where, talk me through how that one came together. I'm really curious.
Yeah, it's kind of a fun story. You know, after Domestics, I was looking for another movie and had written one thing that I was trying to get made and was getting a lot of passes on, and it was things were looking pretty dark. And I remember this guy who I was courting to be a manager, this Noah Rosen, who's over at Writ Large. I was like, Mike, I have this script. You know, take a look at it. You know, don't judge it before you start reading it. And I was like, okay. He sends it to me. It's Wrong Turn.
Hmm.
And I'm just immediately like, oh, God. was kind of the first thing. I was like, oh, okay, here we go. Okay. Oh, you know what? You know what? I'm going to go in. And the thing was, is Alan McElroy, who wrote the original Wrong Turn, also wrote this one. And he was also repped by Noah. And so Noah, you know, was like, you know, I think you're going to like this. I think this is your style. I was like, okay. And, you know, Constantine is doing it. They did the original one. I had recently just gone into Constantine to pitch both this mom style revenge slasher movie and then a shark movie about the shark that eats Olympic athletes in a big atoll island pool thing. And you know, again, two movies that were too weird for everybody. And you know, ultimately Constantine ended up passing on both of them, but it got me in the room to kind of show my stuff in front of Robert Coulter. And once I read Wrong Turn, and as soon as I started reading, I was like, okay, I feel like I can put my DNA on this thing. Not to mention, like, it was like guys running around in the woods with skull masks, and it was survival, and it's just like it just ticked the boxes for me. And it was brutal, and it was a lot of fun, and I loved. For me, it was important that everybody was on board to do something that was so completely different than the original, and not try to make an excuse to kind of go back to those roots. We know that people are going to hate this movie. Like that was almost one of the things, and this is going to sound really weird, but it was one of the things that got me really excited, was when you have a producer saying, look, we know people aren't going to like this because we are going so far from the original, but that's why we feel like we're doing something fun and unique. And I was like, I completely agree. I'm in. And, you know, I got to pitch. Obviously, they had seen a pitch of mine previously, and they were very excited to have me in the room. Pitched them the movie. You know, they said, we'll get back to you. I think it was like a 45-minute pitch over phone, because at one time I was out in L.A. I met with them for briefly and then came back to Minnesota, which is where I live. Pitched the movie over the phone to them, and that's how I got the gig.
Nice.
That's wild. It's so rare to see a franchise make a pivot like that. Especially if it's seven goddamn movies into the thing, you know, that's a really rare thing. I can imagine that being, I don't know, an exciting thing to take on as a filmmaker.
It was, it had a really fresh sense about it. It still had like those, especially in the first half of the movie, it still had the winks at like, you know, the slasher tropes and even the tropes of the original film of the, you know, the young people off in the woods. And so like, I liked that it was playing around with those expectations and then deciding to just say, nope, fuck that. We're going to go completely this way now. And we're going to give you a trial and an execution. And we're just, I was just like, okay, yeah, this is, I like when this kind of stuff happens in movies when I'm watching. Mm-hmm. This will be a lot of fun to actually make.
Your most recent thing, VHS 85, is also kind of a curveball thing. I'm not sure I had ever seen someone do what you did in that movie, which was split your segment up into like two segments that sort of are layered into the movie. I'm curious, how far along in the process were you when you knew that you were going to do that? And how did the rest of the team react to that idea?
I like to say that it's one of the reasons why I got the job. When we went into this, and when I got the call from Josh Goldblum, who I had met for the first time at the premiere for The Domestics out at Cinepocalypse in Chicago, you know, him and I hit it off, and he just seemed like a really, like our souls had a lot in common. And stayed in touch for a little bit, and obviously COVID happened, and, you know, you just kind of lose touch with everything and everybody. And then I get a call from him, or actually it was a Facebook message saying, Mike, can you hop on a call? And I was like, oh boy. And I knew at that point that he was behind 94. And immediately that's where my mind went, was I was like, oh God, is he going to ask me? Like, I was like, oh God, please, please. Knowing full well that I was going to disappoint myself. I didn't, which ended up being awesome, because he goes, look, we are looking for people to pitch for we have two new VHS movies. At that time, they were doing 99 and 85 because we kind of shot them back to back or semi-continuously, actually. Mm. And I was like, oh my God, yes, I'm very interested. He goes, great. Throw together just like three, you know, just couple sentence long pitches and let's just see kind of where your head's at with this and, you know, give us the era that you want. You want 99 or 85, blah, blah, blah. And so I did. I pitched them three ideas and they ended up liking two of them. And of course I ended up picking the one that made it into the movie. Yeah. From that point on, I remember the first pitch I got on, you know, that was one of the things that I brought up to them was just like, hey, like I had this idea where like you have the first part of the story, which is these kids on a lake. And then you have the second part where you're with the killer. At that moment in time, I didn't actually know how I was going to like tell that story of the killer. It was sort of up in the air. I knew I wanted to follow and make that part be a surprise. But I remember specifically pitching to, I think it was David, Brad, and Josh, the idea of like, is there a way we could cut this up and make it feel like two different segments, but then you realize they're combined? And I remember they had a lot of excitement for the idea. I know, you know, one of the things that they said right off the bat was, I mean, this sounds great. We love this idea. Let's see how it works in the editing room, because that's how they find a lot where these segments are right. placed and everything. So mm-hmm. I was like, okay, that's cool. I just told them, I was like, but I'm writing it kind of based on that idea. So just so you know, they're like, and we love that. Just do that. Go for mm-hmm. it. We love the idea. Write and we'll figure it out. And came up with what you saw on the screen. Again, very few notes, just a couple like small little sensical things that had to be nipped in the bud. But honestly, what's on the page is what you see on the screen, of course, with the performers' fun little accents and improvs in there. But that's it. Like that was part of it. And then when they actually found in the edit, when they were cutting together the film as a whole with all the other films, they, you know, at first we almost split it up into three. There was like the sniper sequence up until when Drew dies, and then there was going to be a segment, and then we were going to see the part where Drew wakes up and everybody comes alive, and then they talk what we're going to do, and then another segment was going to come, and then the celebration or the ambrosia segment was going to come. And we did try that actually in one version of the edit, and it didn't work. It was too long. It was too long in between segments. So that's why you had that little blip in between Drew getting shot and then Drew waking up and everybody waking up. You have like the, it's 10 p.m. Do you know where your children are? Right. Which is something that I put together in After Effects. Like I was like, I wanted to get like an old, like one of those 80s toy gun commercials. I think it was called like Intertech or whatever it was called. The toy guns that like sounded real, and I don't know, things are fucking amazing. And I wanted to throw that, but we couldn't get the rights to it. So I was like, well, I got to put something to break this up, just even if it's just like a few seconds, just to kind of so it's not just this initial, just this continuous. I wanted there to be a break from the flow. It was supposed to be like a tape over, you know?
Right.
And those tape overs always had like, I mean, even when you look back at your own family videos, like you accidentally put in the wrong tape and hit record when we were taping an episode of Moonlighting or some shit like that, and you caught an old commercial like, oh shit, this is Mike's second birthday, no, take this out. That was sort of the vibe of trying to do that. But then that's how it all came together, and it all ended up working. And honestly, like, and I say this to everybody that I talk about with the movies, like I'm still waiting for the thing to go wrong with this thing. Like, it's probably one of the best processes I ever had with the greatest group of people, the group of directors that, you know, we got to hang out at Fantastic Fest. It was so cool. I'm still like, wow, we got to make that. Somebody said, go make that.
Yeah. It's an uncommonly strong installment in that franchise, I think, mm-hmm. overall. And I think you managed to knock out the best segment in it, for my money anyway. And I remember being like completely baffled the first time I saw it, like when the cut occurs, mm-hmm. and was like, is that it? That's the end of the set. Okay, well, all right, moving on, you know. And I was just kind of like, well, we'll worry about that later. And then oh, it like hit like an uppercut when it comes back in and you realize right. what's going on. Loved it.
Yeah. Mike, do you, I don't know if you would remember, but we've met before. Not at Fantastic Fest, but one of the very last set visits I did in my time at Ain't It Cool News was the Domestics. So,
oh my God, dude. Yeah, yes.
Yeah. So it was like me and like two other dudes came down to New Orleans, and you were filming out like where like a condemned part of the city that was still fucked up from Katrina or something. It was like right near the levees, I guess, is where that neighborhood or whatever that you shot. Yes, in.
And we went out to eat with the producers and everything at that nice restaurant. That's right. How are you?
Yeah. Oh, I'm great. The Ain't It Cool thing didn't work out, but that wasn't your fault. So no, that was a lot of fun, and I just wanted to say hello and make sure that you knew that you were talking to internet royalty Eric Vespi.
No, that's fantastic. No, I love it because it was you. I think it was John Squires from Bloody Disgusting, and
that
what's the guy from Slash? I can't remember his name.
Peter Serretta, or was it somebody else?
Young guy. Oh God, I can't remember.
I don't know. We have a photo. We took a photo in front of like the car. That's like, you can take a picture in front of a car. That's what we'll allow you to do. So
I have that picture on my computer. I'm going to send it to you guys after we jump off this thing because I still have it. I pulled it up it was just a couple days ago. I was going through some set pictures or whatever from random projects. And I found that one. I was like, oh yeah, look at that. It's
look at those fucking tubby nerds.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
That was a good day.
Yeah, well, I'm glad. I remember being impressed with what you guys were doing. I remember Tyler told me a story about learning how to play craps from Paul Newman. Because he was the kid in Road to Perdition. And when I think I was the first one of the group to kind of put that together, and I'm just like, holy shit, you know, Road to Perdition fucking rules. He's like, yeah, thanks. It was great. I learned to gamble from Paul Newman. It's like, that's a hell of a story. Now he's Superman. So there you go.
Yep.
Yeah, no, that was fun, man.
We're all growing up now.
I know. Yeah. Grown up, moved on to bigger and better things. Yeah. And talking about some Stephen King goodness. So this actually might be a good spot to ask your Stephen King origin story, which is to say, when did Stephen King kind of pop onto your radar, either as a presence in pop culture, or what was the thing that you saw or read or, you know, noticed that kind of made you notice him or made you a fan?
Yeah. It's got to be... Sorry, I had to take my headphones off for a second and grab something off my shelf because I think this is what it was. But
yeah.
So growing up, I really was not allowed to watch any Stephen King or read any Stephen King. It was very, very much off the table. That was, if anything, Stephen King wrote characters about people who wanted to be the devil. So that was it was very much like anything R-rated or anything Stephen King was kind of like, no, you got to be careful with that stuff. It's basically a Ouija board.
Religious and, family.
Yeah, not in like the weird crazy way, but just in like the like movies were a big deal in our house. Like it was just you got to be careful what you watch kind of thing. And at a young age, you know, my dad. We would always watch like, you know, the James Wells Frankenstein, Creature from the Black Lagoon. You know, we still watched all the Indiana Jones movies and all the Star Wars. It wasn't like movies were off the table. It was just anything R-rated, anything Stephen King, anything with like too much blood and gore or swearing. It was just like, no,
right.
not in the house. But I also my parents were antique dealers and collectible dealers, and they do like antique shows. They were in a lot of antique stores and booths and so forth. And so we would do garage sailing and estate sailing. And I think the thing that I remember the most, like if I'm going to go way back to like when I was, gosh, maybe 5 or 6, it was a couple of things. It was seeing the Skeleton Crew book.
Sure.
With the monkey, with the monkey,
with the symbols,
Right.
Yeah,
I remember seeing that specifically and thinking, not only was that creepy, but it was super cool, and someday I was going to read that. and then, of course, the first time I think I ever saw Monster Squad, I was about five or six. I was pretty young. And again, that was a movie that after we watched it, which it was given to us by a family member, like, it was actually my godfather. He had a VHS tape of it that he had taped off HBO. And so it had the great HBO logo at the beginning, and it like, and,
yeah. And that opening music, the feature presentation music.
Oh my God. So it would have been the Skeleton Crew book, and then it would have been Andre Gower wearing the Stephen King's Rules shirt.
Rules shirt, yep.
And it just thinking, you know, again, just thinking to myself, like, okay, like, I'd love this movie. Like, Stephen King's got to be doing some pretty cool stuff. And then I want to say that, like, if I was to really harken back and think of the first movie, the first Stephen King movie that I maybe watched all the way through, I was younger, but not like super young. I was probably early teens, preteen or something like that. And I remember watching Cat's Eye on TV with my dad. And it was interesting because like he was really into it and so was I. And I don't even know if he knew it was a Stephen King thing, but that being this cool anthology thing and having a very fun like experience with that one, you know, just it did leave a pretty big impression on me and thinking like, okay, yeah, I have to start exploring more of this stuff and never get like the little goblin and Drew Barrymore and the smoking thing and the wife with her finger cut off. And like, there was this very, very visceral imagery. And at the time I didn't quite understand the opening credit sequence with all the nods to all this stuff. But of course watching it, you know, as I got older, I was like, oh, this is so cool. Like I never even realized this.
Yeah. Cujo and Christine. And
yes.
Everything's popping up. One of the things that we hear a lot on the show, it's either I had a parent who was really into it or it was forbidden. Like those seem to be the two ways into Stephen King. And like either one or both of them like lead to the same place of like, no, I end up, you know, respecting this person. I've read everything they've done or I've watched all the movies, but I don't know which one's like stronger. Like in my mind, I would guess that the like it being forbidden and it being daring and kind of rebellious to read it or watch something might make the Stephen King bonding that you do maybe a little stronger, I'd guess, than just starting from like, hey, my parents like this and said, hey, you should read this, you know. But that's not my experience, so I can't really tell for sure. But there's just something in me that, you know, that says that there's kind of a universal truth that if your parents forbid something and you go do it, like it's going to have a stronger connection to it. You know, if you love it,
probably.
Let's just put it out there. There's definitely a reason why I'm making the types of movies that I'm making. There's a reason why I get excited by dealing with this genre. I do feel like some of that has to do with the fact that, I mean, I don't know if them just letting me watch whatever or not letting me watch anything would have had an impact. It's hard to say, you know, I don't know if like I would have gotten over it had I just watched stuff or if I would have just been like, no, I actually really do like this stuff. I'm going to continue.
Right.
You know, it's hard to say at this point, but whatever they did, I turned out okay. And I'm here doing what I love to do. So,
So did you keep up reading King over the years? Like, have you stuck with him or are you checking it out? Like what level are you? What level of fanboy are you?
I'm a check in and out kind of guy. Occasionally we'll watch a movie. Occasionally we'll pick up one of the old paperbacks. Like, got the old Night Shift paperback that has the holes cut out in the cover with the eyes peering through.
Yeah.
It's just like, again, the artwork for the King novels. And I mean, even a handful of the King movie posters is so iconic. It's so recognizable and it leaves such, you know, it's like when you walked into the video store and when you saw the poster for Graveyard Shift, you were like, oh, this is going to be some serious shit. it had a different impact when I actually ended up watching it for the first time.
Right.
I often feel like, again, like, especially in that time frame, some of those posters, you know, especially through the 80s and early 90s, were so much more effective than the movies themselves.
Big time.
Yeah.
Big time. Yeah. There comes a point in any kid from my generation. Like, I was born in the early 80s, so I was firmly in the video store age. There comes a point where something clicks and you realize that a good cover does not mean a good movie, or that you'll even see anything that's on that cover. But like, I'll remember even like the Garbage Pail Kids movie cover is like this giant, you know, art, science fiction, weird art, you know, poster. And then you watch the movie and it's a bunch of little people running around and like just a step up from paper mache fucking, you know, heads. Being all gross. You know, I don't know. I look fondly at that. I don't know if kids today would have the patience for, you know, the package not completely advertising exactly what you're getting, you know?
Oh, 100%. But it's unfortunate because that was sort of like, I mean, when you went to a video store like that, it was like you're going to an art gallery, man. Like, it was so, it was such an impressive thing to walk through. I mean, it was so overwhelming, but at the same time, it was the best feeling of being overwhelmed because you could just, it's where I think I got a lot of some of the weird, crazy stuff that's in my head is I looked at those images and I made up stories on the spot. Like, what is this going to be? I wouldn't even read the back of the cover usually and find out what the movie was actually about. I'd be like, oh God. Like, you just start to pull, you take that image and you would just completely craft these small little moments in your head. Just try to scare yourself.
Yeah.
So go ahead.
Oh, I think we're going in the same direction.
Yeah.
So when you looked at, you mentioned Graveyard Shift, is this how you came across the movie the first time? Is that it is on the video store shelf, or was it like an HBO thing, or did you see it in theaters? Like, what was your, or did you only watch it yesterday in preparation for this episode? I don't know. So tell me a little bit about your history with this, because this is one that Scott and I both kind of came to, we came to this one very late. Like, I don't think either one of us had actually given this a real shot until we started the show.
Yeah.
And it became like kind of quickly a surprise, like, holy shit, this feels like we uncovered a lost, you know, treasure from 1990 here.
Yeah. Yeah. I did not watch this until much later myself, I believe. So I was one of the very, very early Netflix subscribers when he had the DVD queue.
Yeah.
I had
the good old days, the red envelope days. Yeah.
So good. I mean, getting one of those red things in the mail was like, if you were to go and like say like, okay, you have the video store and then you had, you know, the Netflix thing. It's like once the video stores were kind of like falling away, now I look back and just in that, it didn't even seem like that long ago, but just in that time frame, you're just like, wow, when you would open the mail and get a red envelope, you were like, yes! It was such a good feeling. That's when I watched
it. I felt like you were robbing somebody, because it was like, you could get like a Criterion, you know, release or something, and you're like, oh my God, I got the Criterion disc in the mail. I'm only paying, you know, what, $9 a month or something, you know, Blockbuster is so fucked.
Yes, I know. And I mean, again, like, it was such a cool technological thing, and like, you could just pick what movies you wanted and line them up in a queue as many as you wanted. And it would just, you could like switch one from the bottom to the top. Anyway, that was when I first watched this movie. I believe it was one of the first movies. The very first movie that I ever rented on with the Netflix discs was Deadly Spawn. I'd never seen it before.
Okay.
Never seen it before, but I remember putting Deadly Spawn. That was the very, very first one that I ever rented from Netflix. But I believe Graveyard Shift was definitely in like the first top 10 to 15 that I ever got from Netflix. And that was the first time that I watched it. So I had to have been in my early 20s. I was still in college. I think it was probably a junior or a senior in college. And remember watching it on my little Sony, like 19-inch or 21-inch Trinitron screen in my room, and that in my dorm, and yeah, that was the first time I saw it.
Yeah, I think I had maybe seen bits and pieces of it before we did the show, like on HBO or something back in the day, but had not sat down and like really watched it all the way through. And I think that on the one hand, I think this is a bad movie. On the other hand, I really enjoy this movie. Like, Like, it's just a fucking balls out creature feature. I think it's really interesting that there's like no one of any note in it other than Brad Dourif, you know? Like, it's mostly unknowns or relative unknowns, you know. I guess like Stephen Mocht, maybe not so much, but you know what I mean. This isn't like this is not a prestige thing. It is quite clearly like a quick and dirty, like, we're going to build some giant fucking rat puppets movie. And I just respect it for that.
Right. Yeah, no, it's a lot of fun. I like that it leans heavily into the main aspect of King, which I think a lot of people either shy away from or, you know, or I don't know, especially nowadays, it just feels like, listen, I know that the It movies take place in Maine, but like, you don't, you know, it doesn't, there's no Maine character, right? You don't have anybody going with a crazy accent, but I guess maybe like nowadays, that's just not the accent. Cause we've been to Bangor now. And, you know, I've been, twice and I've only run into like two people that kind of sound like they'd be Stephen King characters up there. Everybody else just has a neutral American accent. So, yeah. so maybe those days are over, but, you know, nobody told Stephen Mocht that when he made this movie.
Can we talk about Stephen Mocht? And, I mean, obviously he's, to me, most famous for Monster Squad.
Big time.
Yeah. Del.
The dad. Yeah, the dad Monster Squad.
And
the cool cop dad that, like, that, you know, is like the dad every kid wanted when they were watching Monster Squad.
And just I always, again, not to stray away from Graveyard Shift, but like, just was effortless in his like portrayal of just the beat down, tired of this shit kind of cop with the partner who just like could not stop cracking jokes about every like.
Yep.
And you just see it on his feet. But like, I think that's the thing. What's great about Mocht is like, and these two movies is he is a great character actor.
And
I think, you know, again, this proves it. And one thing that I don't think fully, what's the word, appreciate maybe the first time I watched, because again, like, to your point, Scott, you know, first time I saw this, I was kind of like, oh boy, like, that's not what I was expecting. And I'm not sure it was in a good way. Like, it's always refreshing when you sit down and you put in a movie and it's like, you know, great practical creature effects, and you know, there's lots of ooze and goo, you know, goopy stuff and slime, and like, you can, like, honestly, like, I a lot of times prefer, like, even though you can tell it's a puppet, like, it looks like a fucking puppet, but fuck, it looks cool, you know what I mean? Like, there, I can see it in front of me, I could touch it if I could reach through the screen. The one thing that I didn't appreciate so much until I watched a supercut of Stephen Mocht of Warwick's all of his scenes on YouTube,
mm-hmm.
and just like all of his lines strung together, it's phenomenal. Like, I mean, if you sit down, I think there's a video online that's like 10 minutes long, and it's all his like great lines that he says throughout the movie, and it's just it's so much fun to just see him back to back.
Yeah, like, he is really chewing the scenery in this fucking thing.
I know, he eats it. He's like, oh, getting ready for Star Search.
Yeah, if he doesn't have a mustache, but he is nonetheless twirling it the entire movie, and it is so 100%. So delicious. I want to tell a Stephen Mocht story real quick. So this is another set visit I went on way back in the day, because I'd been on, I'd visited Sin City a couple of times, and I knew Rodriguez, and I guess I got on Frank Miller's radar because of that. So I got an invite to have my own day visiting the set of his masterpiece, The Spirit, which stars Good Gabriel Lord. Mocht, which is Stephen Mocht's son. And when I was there, you know, Scarlett Johansson and like all these other like super famous people are in this movie that history has rightfully forgotten. It's not a good movie. But when I was there, I'm like, holy shit, I'm going to go up and tell, you know, Gabriel Mocht, like, I'm a big fan of his dad. And who else is on that fucking set visiting his kid but Stephen Mocht that day? And so like, I'm there watching like all these super famous people act on, you know, against a green screen, right? In a green screen box. And I just saddle up over to Stephen Mocht and I go, you know, you fucking rule in the Monster Squad, right? And he's like, oh, he seems so shocked that anybody would even know who he was. And then I ended up getting to host a couple of screenings of Monster Squad over the years because I'm a giant nerd for it. I hosted the original, the very first reunion screening back in the day. And to this day, you know, the Andre and Fred Decker and those folks, they still credit me with kind of revitalizing things. And I, for that so movie cool. and for getting on DVD, it's a credit that I do not deserve, but I will fucking embrace every single time. But yeah, because of that, I ended up getting to host a whole bunch of Monster Squad screenings over the years. And I've done a couple with Stephen Mocht. And that dude just is down to earth and like just kind of, he seems confused as to why, you know, this resurgence of adoration is happening. But yeah, that's my Stephen Mock story.
Humble guy. I love it.
This episode is sponsored by Founders Day, starring Devin Druid, Naomi Grace, William Russ, and Amy Hargreaves. In this satirical political slasher from the Blomquist brothers, a small town is shaken by a series of ominous killings in the days leading up to a heated mayoral election. As accusations fly and the threat of a mass killer looms, the residents must race to uncover the truth before fear consumes the town. Founders Day is now available to rent or buy on demand.
Very well done, Eric. And I'm here to tell you about another of our episode's sponsors, Experience I Saw the TV Glow. Now playing in select cities from A24 and director Jane Schoenburn and starring Justice Smith and Bridget Lundy Payne, teenager Owen is just trying to make it through life in the suburbs when his classmates introduce him to a mysterious late-night TV show, a vision of a supernatural world beneath their own. In the pale glow of the television, Owen's view of reality begins to crack. Critics are raving. This is a, quote, coming-of-age masterpiece that will follow you home. Don't miss I Saw the TV Glow, certified fresh and now playing in select cities nationwide May 17th. Get your tickets now for the love of God. And Vespi, let's get back to the show.
Let's do it.
This movie was not well received. It has
it was not
0% on Rotten Tomatoes. Stephen King has said that he hates it. that it's and called it a quick exploitation picture. Mm-hmm. My question on that though is, what did he think the movie was going to be? Like, because if you read the short story, I mean, it's a pretty faithful adaptation of the short story. It's been expanded a little bit, I think, but like, yeah. I'm confused what else it would be if not an exploitation picture. Can you imagine a version of this?
A Norma Ray style drama about about cruel working conditions. Yeah.
Yeah. I think it's a strange little little note to this thing.
Yeah.
It's interesting. Like, I mean, I really enjoy how lean and mean the short is. Would it be a stretch to turn just that story and maybe just make it that like those one or two, or what would it be, those two nights or whatever in the basement cleaning it out into a film? Maybe. I mean, here's my take. I do feel like there's a lot of fluff, isn't the right word, but there's a lot of extra padding in this movie before we really get to the stuff that like actually matters. I mean, again, I think it's important that we set up, you know, the cruel foreman and what he's capable of, that of course that this, there's something lurking in the mill. You know, I think that's fine. I do feel like there was somebody, the writer, the screenplay or whoever, or maybe it was just a room full of executives who thought that there needed to be the typical formulaic stuff to make this a horror movie at the time. And to me, that's the way that it comes off. And so there's a certain part of me that understands where King is coming from, where he doesn't like this, because I do look at it and it does kind of feel, it's paced weird. It's definitely uneven. It doesn't know what, like, it leans into some kind of harder drama and some kind of tricky situations, but then gets goofy sometimes. And it doesn't quite know what its vibe wants to be. which again, I feel like is a huge proponent of 80s and early 90s, you know, genre fare. I guess you could even say today as well. It's just part of it. But that's the way that, I mean, I remember watching it for the first time and feeling that way. I remember just like, I watched this a few weeks ago, just to remind myself again, on the movie. And again, like walking away, like having a different kind of appreciation, really having a strong, much stronger appreciation for Brad Dourif's character, wishing that the whole fucking movie was following Brad Dourif exterminating fucking rats. Like, that's the movie, man. That's the movie I'd want to see right there. I mean, some, you know, Vietnam vet who takes up this profession. Strangely, what a great metaphor. It's a very strange, uneven movie with these, like, glints of, like, fun that never fully add up to being this wow. You know what I mean? It comes across as, like, to your point, what you guys said earlier about, like, this strange little creature feature gem that we didn't watch until we were much older and being like, wow, they're really doing it. Like, this is like a, they're doing like a full on rat movie and there's a giant rat bat and it's like eating people and holy shit. But yeah, it just uneven. Doesn't fully work. But again, there are those glimmers.
Right. It's not a classic by any means. It doesn't stand shoulder to shoulder with the best of its era, let alone, you know, the classics of genre, but it is weirdly nostalgic in the kind of movie that isn't made anymore. It's like, this is
true.
It is in that small window. Forgive me, listener, if this is a point I brought up last time we talked about this title, but it is bizarre that like late 80s, early 90s window where if this movie had come out, this exact movie with this exact cast had come out 2 years later, it would have been like a direct-to-video movie, right?
Yes.
But it isn't. It's theatrical because it came out in that window when, you know, these little low-budget, odd horror things can happen. But it was also after the death of the slasher, and there was like no, you know, the horror was just kind of aimless at this point. There wasn't like that steady, you know, every generation has the horror movie that like sets the tone of what horror is for that decade. Right. And there's just like, this is kind of like that aimless, like looking for the next horror thing, you know, before Scream would come along, I guess. But, I don't know. It's just this perfect, like little weird ball of, you know, fluff. He's like a little golden retriever puppy. This movie, it's just like wanting you to have a good time. And it's like, here, you want a 4 minute USS Indianapolis monologue from Brad Dourif, but about rats in Vietnam. It's like, here you go. It's like, and to your point, so that stuff is so good. And Brad Dourif is so good in this that it's actually a detriment to the movie because you do have that thing where it's like, why isn't that the movie? Exactly. As you said, why isn't he the character that's introduced? And then the, you know, you have one straight man, you know, character following him through this, his insane, like just vengeance to kill all rats and include, you know, it's like that, that is,
yeah, and
that is the movie. That is, it's so good that it fucking hurts the rest of the movie.
It is. It's such a shining star in the movie. And you know what's interesting is like you look at the character of Hall from the book, and then the character of Hall in this, and
yeah,
it's a you know the character of Hall in the movie is such gray matter. There's nothing there to grab onto. He is the character in the book, but with like far less to say, and with far less of an agenda. At least in the book, he's like, and maybe even the book doesn't even go as far as I'd like it with this, but like, I love the fact that like, he makes a point to you really see his dislike of Warwick and what he's about in the book. And it makes that very apparent. Whereas here you have in the movie, you have like, there's like the kind of the side love story with Wiskonski, and who in the movie is the girl, and in the book is the heavyset guy,
right?
And so that kind of changes up things, and he's just kind of like, he's just kind of the white bread, like kind of bland guy that says all the right things and stands up for the right people, and
right,
he doesn't really do anything wrong. Whereas in the book,
he's a boring lead. Yeah,
yeah, he's a boring lead, but in the book, he actually does something pretty ballsy, and King kind of, in the end, turns him into like the villain almost, and like takes Warwick with him and like makes sure that Warwick dies, sprays him with a hose into like the weird bat rat creature, so he's alive. And then he's trying to escape, and then the fucking rats start like biting him, and like the thing grabs onto his head and sinks its teeth into his neck, and you're just like, holy shit, like this guy went from like the good college kid who's like threatening Warwick to being like, I'm gonna take this guy down, and now the rats are gonna take him down. You're just like, oh my god, like, that's that to me is like, I think that's again where the story does something a little bit, just a little bit more ballsy. You know what I mean with him and paints him, or at least turns him into somebody who isn't just very straight and narrow, and that guy that we're all supposed to relate to, which I couldn't relate to this guy. He's just.
No, there's nothing to
him. He's boring.
Like he's a manila envelope of a character. The thing you were talking about earlier about the tone of it being all over the map is maybe symptomatic of the fact that this was directed by a guy named Ralph S. Singleton. His only other directorial credits ever were on two episodes of Cagney and Lacey. One and done on this one. Like that's how poorly received this was. Or maybe he just like didn't like directing or something. I don't know. But
sure.
It's you don't often see someone tackling a King property who has only made just that one movie. Well, Stephen King himself, I suppose, with Maximum Overdrive.
Right.
You know, that's I wonder if that like, you know, uneven tone comes down to just like this director just didn't have a firm grasp on the material or how he wanted to portray it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's possible.
When you watch a movie like this now, you know, now that you've gotten a few movies under your belt, are you aware of, you know, are you consciously aware of like directorial choices that are going on, or, you know, where the person making the movies coming up short or succeeding in ways that maybe most people wouldn't recognize? Like, can you watch Graveyard Shift now and go, oh yeah, no, this Ralph dude totally fucked it? Or do you watch it and just go, yeah, I don't know what happened, but it just didn't come together, you know?
I mean, yeah, I do believe that it's possible that some of it came down to just creative vision, experience. I mean, the guy, I mean, you look at his IMDb and he'd been on a lot of projects. He'd been like, what, like assistant directors and UPMs or something like that. I can't remember all of his credits.
A lot of production credits, yeah.
Yeah, but you know, he really wasn't dealing with anything solely creative. So, you know, again, like you can tell he's like aware of how to put together a movie, but it's almost like he was never getting enough material or making the material stand out. You know what I mean? It was like, it was kind of a point the camera.
Right.
Kind of deal.
And he doesn't modulate his actors, because you have Stephen Mocht, who's just going off on Crazy Town, you know, the whole time. He's going so broad. And then you have David Andrews as Hall, who's just playing it so low key and dull. And yeah, there isn't any sort of attempt to bridge those two, that gap, you know what I mean? So, and maybe that just comes down to, you know, him just putting the movie together is the important part. And, you know, it doesn't really matter to him, you know, what the performances are and how that's, you know, layering in with the rest of the movie. I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, and I'd also just want to venture out, not to speak poorly of producers or executives, but like, just, it does feel like there was a lot of meddling and a lot of, again, unnecessary things that were plugged into the movie that, again, I mean, at 86 minutes or whatever this movie is, like, it's already lean and mean, but it's strange. The movie still feels longer than 86 minutes.
Oh, yeah.
Unfortunately, but like, the idea is so concise in the book that it wanders a little bit. And I'm wondering again, if it was one of those things that, those moments in time where they needed to have certain things and they needed to do things a certain way. And there was pressure from studio heads to show this, to make sure this was there, that just kind of cluttered it. Cause even for instance, like when Brad Dourif gets killed, it's so just like, it just kind of happens, and not in a way that's like a good shocking, it just comes out of nowhere, not like a Samuel L. Jackson death from Deep Blue Sea. It's like,
right.
It's like, it just, suddenly we have a scene in which Brad Dourif is wandering around and then a big tomb crushes his head, which again, also felt like a huge producer note. It's called Graveyard Shift, so we got to have a graveyard in the movie. Like that to me is like, that to me was very telling of like somebody who had to have it spelled out, which a lot of times I feel like comes from that aspect or can.
Right.
But yeah.
You bring up a good point, because that death scene, this character's clearly Quint. He's trying to be make him Quint. He gives him the backstory of why he hates these things. He's the expert in killing these things.
Yeah.
He's a Quint character. And, you know, when you watch Jaws, Spielberg, when Quint goes out, he fucking goes out. Literally makes a meal of Quint's death, you know, scene. Mm-hmm. And yeah, so it does. Like, just as a cinephile watching this, like, you just are kind of promised that this guy's going to go out. He's going to be, you know, Ahab and the whale and all that shit. That's going to happen. But yeah, then he just kind of just gets squashed. And it's like, out of all this stuff, that should have been a, like, I don't know. I'm thinking the intensity of the werewolf attack at the beginning of An American Werewolf in London, right? It's just like he needed that moment, you know, to go out and, you know, screaming and fighting the whole way. You know, that's what that character needs, not, you know, not to unfortunately get his head popped by a fucking tombstone that falls. Yeah. Like a fucking anvil in a Looney Tunes cartoon.
It's so obviously what they should have done that I almost wonder, like, maybe they tried to film that and that just they couldn't pull it off, you know, with the effects that they had, or. And so they went with this, because it's like really just perfunctory. And you're right. The way is everything about that character screams that I'm going to go out in like a hail of rat bullets.
More. You're right.
Yes. Yeah.
Ran out of time. They had Dora for 3 days and they fucking ran out of time. They're like, oh, damn. Well, I guess a tombstone will fall on you. And now you can go back to whatever your other obligations are. Yeah.
Well, and I mean, just the way that they're structuring the movie, in which they're trying to again keep the big bat monster under wraps. Like, what are we leading up to? I mean, honestly, I didn't read much about this movie before I watched it for the first time. So when it got to what the thing actually was, there was actually some surprise. Because I'm expecting like a horde of rats. Or a slightly bigger rat or something like that. And then it ends up being this weird slimy bat creature. And I was like, oh, that's kind of cool.
Yeah.
But yeah, for him not to, it seemed like, again, they're hiding their gag up until when they really have to show it, which again, like, well, if Stephen Mock, if Warwick is the bad guy is when we got to see this thing. And, you know, Dwarf's not the bad guy, so does he really deserve to get eaten by the monster? I'm like, well, he's the one killing the rats, so at least have him swarmed by a bunch of rats.
Right.
It's really weird.
The obsession's got to be the thing that kills him, not a tombstone. So.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it's the graveyard shift.
It's the graveyard shift.
Which, come on, can we talk about this song? Which is incredible, dude.
Oh, yeah.
I mean... like it does. It harkens back to the songs like the Monster Squad that are like made for the movie. And this one, of course, made up of all samples.
It's insane when that thing hits at the end. You're like, what?
It's just all quotes from the movie you just fucking watched. Yeah.
Yeah, like a victory lap of pull quotes from the movie. Ugh. Yeah. I don't know. Maybe I don't like this movie. The more talking about it.
Well, I will say when we talked about like the options of movies to that we could go through and discuss on the show, it was never my intention to pick the ones that I like am head over heels in love with. Like I always find that that can kind of be a little one-sided. It can be a little easy. And so like picking, I can't remember like the ones that I threw out at you guys, but like, this was one of them where I'm like, you know what? I know I watched this once. I know I wasn't a huge fan of it, but I remember liking the creature effects. Maybe this could be a good one. And I'm working on a creature feature myself. So I'm like, this is like the end. I love this. Okay. And so that was sort of like why I wanted to revisit it, you know, reread the story, rewatch the movie. and like kind of immerse myself into why, what were the things that weren't working? What things are working? What do I like about it now, as opposed to maybe after the first watch where I was, you know, slightly disappointed. And there are things that I watch on it now, I'm like, okay, so this is cool. I have way more respect for Brad Dourif, like, as a part of this movie now. It's just like incredible, especially like what's that line that Brad Dourif says, where he's like, "And don't look at me like I'm some baby burning sob story that you see Bruce Dern playing." Like, I lost it. I was like, this is so good. Like, I don't want this to end. Like, keep telling me the story.
Well, I don't know. I didn't rewatch it for this, so I'm kind of going by memory. But like, because I've seen it now, like, I don't know, several times. But
yeah,
you are right that picking a movie that you love is, or a story that you love is not necessarily the, what we have found doing the show, that doesn't always pan out very well. Because, like, you know how hard it is to have an hour-long conversation about The Shawshank Redemption? Like, more than once? Because, like, there's not much to say about it when it's, like, a perfect film.
Yes.
Like,
yep.
That's really all you can say. And so, like, we've kind of taken Shawshank off the board as a possible title at this point. Because, like, I think we did it two or three times. And it was, like, the last time was, like, pulling teeth, just trying to find anything remotely new to say about this thing. The bad ones are much more fun to chew over. You know, like, I had more fun talking about all of the Mangler movies than I ever had talking about Shawshank. And that's crazy.
Oh, it's amazing.
Tell us about the creature feature you're working on now. This is Titan.
Yeah. You know,
can you talk about it?
I mean, just kind of based on what's been put out there. It's, you know, we set out in the Amazon with some, you know, Doctors Without Borders going out there to give vaccines to some remote villages, and they run into some bad people and something that
they run into some anti-vaxxers trying to stop them from yeah, right? Implanting the natives with the Bill Gates' microchips.
Yeah, you know,
it's a very political movie.
Yeah, very, very political. no, I mean, it's you know, at its core, it is. It's a fun, giant creature movie that you know, again, my goal when, again, I was approached with this movie by Constantine, much like Wrong Turn, and, you know, I wasn't, you know, in the, and I'm not sure if you guys are familiar with the synopsis that came out about, like, you know, that they run into this thing in the jungle called the Boyuna, but the Boyuna is a giant snake. And, I, you know, at first glance, it's just kind of like, I never thought in a million years I would do a movie that had a giant snake in it. But, like, again, when, you know, you start to, like, pour yourself into it and you start to, like, you know, you rework the story. I got to work with Alan McElroy again on the script, and we really came up with something really fun and unique and surprising. And we didn't want to lean into like what the silliness of like what a snake movie is normally
right.
So often, you know, that
the anaconda problem.
We've seen anaconda.
Don't get me wrong, like fucking anaconda is one of my love songs. But I really wanted to make like a straight up a horror survival film again, and do it in a way that I had never seen it done before. And this was that opportunity. I was like, okay, here's how I'd like to do it, and they responded. And so I was like, okay, here we go. And you know, we're off and running, and fingers crossed.
When do you start shooting?
You know, that's something we're trying to figure out, but it will be this year.
Right on.
Nice. Yeah. Yeah.
You got Jessica Roth on board for that. She rules.
Jessica Roth and Keanu Madera from the Fear Street movies. And yeah, they're just the
surprisingly
phenomenal.
Good Fear Street movies. Yeah.
Dude, they're so good.
Yeah. Yeah. That was one of the bigger like streaming surprises, was how much I enjoyed the Fear Streets. Like, I think that first one in particular was just like, because that was the one that hits you going, oh, I don't really know what the fuck's going to happen here. It's correct. Like, I haven't felt that way watching genre in forever. It's like people that you think are the lead characters get killed off, and people that should be the first ones to die make it to the end. And it's just like, it's like, yeah, it's like, holy shit. Like, I'm not used to to my genre being unpredictable, let alone, you know, a YA, you know, Netflix series or whatever, you know?
Well, and I think the parts that were so surprising to me were that there were, and I know it's like something that I believe Lee said that she wanted to explore more of, but like they're the small little side horror characters that just show up in the lore.
Right.
Like the kid who's like bashing the person in the bed over in the head. You're just like,
yep.
You're just kind of like, wait, I didn't think I was watching this kind of movie, but
yeah.
Let's
very gory.
Let's keep going. Yeah, it was very just like no hold barred. We're just gonna let this happen, and I was really, I was stunned.
Yeah, well, obviously stunned enough to want to cast one of the characters or the actors from that. Yeah.
Oh my gosh. And, yeah, and she, and again, like what's so great about her is like I was talking to her. I was like, yeah, this movie we're gonna literally be in like the muck and the dirt. It's just gonna be this very like dirty, sweaty, like gritty, kind of gross in the jungle type movie. Very, very unflattering. And she's like, I'm in. That's exactly the kind of shit I want to do. And I'm just like, awesome.
Well, now you need to cast Brad Dourif in it as the snake expert.
Yes.
Oh my gosh.
To come in. And then you need to right the wrongs of Graveyard Shift. And he has a giant battle to the death with a giant snake.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. Amazing. It'd be so good.
So not to rewrite your entire movie and fuck things up now, but as somebody who has not read a word of the script, I now have demands, and so in that way I think I'm now an exec on the film. So
yeah, hope you got room in the budget for Dourif.
Nice.
Well, this is usually the point in the show where we invite our guests to tell people where they can find them online, where they can watch your movies, all that kind of stuff. Self-promo corner time. Go for it.
Oh, boy. Well, in terms of an online presence, I'm pretty low-key. It's just on Instagram. My Instagram handle is Rockford Road. Don't post a whole lot, but you'll see a few things come up here and there about projects coming up or stuff like that, or pictures of my son and I playing pinball machines or something.
By the way, I remember visiting you guys on the domestics. Your kid came like during lunch, and it was like his birthday or somebody's birthday, and I just thought it was really cool that it, like, because he was a little kid.
It was my birthday. Shooting in that neighborhood on December 18th or around that time, and I think that was like people were like pinning money to my shirt or something. I never experienced that before, but and he was there and it was so great. He was like, I'll never forget that when he went up to Sonoya Mizuno and just starts talking to her. just gibberish. And she gets down and she's just like, oh yeah, and like right next to her is like her like blown off head corpse. It was just it was very, very cute, a very, very fun moment.
Didn't mean to interrupt, but there you go.
No, all good. Tangents are my MO.
Good.
And in terms of the work, I think Domestics is out there on, you know, physical, and then I believe it's on, you know, Amazon Prime for rent or whatever. Right. Wrong Turn, same thing. I believe it was on Showtime. It might still be on Showtime. And then obviously Amazon and the streaming renters or physical. And then VHS 85 just was released on physical just a couple weeks ago. So I highly recommend checking that out. And then, of course, it's on Shudder.
Right on. And we highly recommend that everyone listening check out those movies as well. This guy's the real deal. He knows what he's doing. And we're very excited to see Titan whenever it comes out. You'll have to come back and talk to us after you've had the experience of making your very own creature feature.
Yes.
Dude, and, absolutely.
And bring Brad Dourif with you.
Yes.
dude, that would be a hell of a show.
we'll see what we can do.
Many thanks to Mike P. Nelson for joining us. Yes. I like that dude. He's like
a delight.
he's legitimately like just one of the nicest guys. I don't know. So there's something about horror that like all these people who are attracted to it that like want to come and be like writer directors and make their little spooky tales. They're almost always like just the nicest, chillest dudes. And so what are you hiding, Mike P. Nelson? That's what I want to know.
They're not weirdos. They're not freaks.
No, that's our job.
They're not outcasts. Yes, exactly. You know, but yeah, a lovely gentleman, and we're really looking forward to his next movie that we talked about on the show. And fucking, if you haven't seen VHS 85, please go watch that. And also, please take Patton Oswalt's advice and go watch Wrong Turn. That shit rules.
Yeah.
Like, I loved it.
Okay, so here's the thing, is I want to underline just how fucking bonkers next week's episode is for you guys. One, it's a guest that never in a million years would I have thought would have been into Stephen King or would come on the show, or when he did end up being one of the funniest, like coolest dudes to talk to.
Fuck yes. Is this one?
Yes, this one. Oh, Next week on the KingCast, fucking Renny Harlin is on the show. We're talking about the director of Cliffhanger, Deep Blue Sea, the guy that makes all those ridiculous bonkers action movies from
The Long Kiss Goodnight.
What?
The Long Kiss Goodnight.
Oh, I thought you said he's a knight. And I'm like, get the fuck out of here. Really? How did that work? I wouldn't
Sir Renny Harlin.
Knight Sir Renny Harlin. I'm going to start calling him Sir Renny Harlin now. So Sir Renny Harlin's on the show next week. He's talking about The Shining, specifically Kubrick and his influence. And I can't stress just how fun this episode is. He's directing the new trilogy of Strangers movie, so it was a natural fit for a Fangoria podcast show. Of course, get the horror thing in there, but I still can't believe he came on, and like by the end of it he was just like, I love you guys, I just want to come and hang out and bullshit movies all day with you. And it's that kind of conversation. It was one of the most surprising things that we've ever done on the show.
I was stunned by the recording of this. I guess my like opinion of Renny Harlin was like kind of mid grade, and then after this, I was like, that guy fucking owns so hard, like funny as shit, has great stories. I don't know. This is a promo appearance, so like the Shining stuff that you're gonna get might not be as pronounced as, you know, maybe the Stranger stuff, but like wall to wall gold. Like he is incredible to listen to.
Yeah. He's got some great stories.
I'm really hyped for this one to be out there.
He directed Nightmare on Elm Street 4, and I brought it up, and he takes that into like a 5 minute, like incredible story about how he got that gig. And
yeah.
And then that leads into him talking about Steven Spielberg calling him because he loved Nightmare 4. It's wild.
Yeah,
it's wild. It's so good. Crazy. I just want to tell everybody exactly everything we talked about. So I'm going to have to rein myself in. Tune in next week. You'll hear it all. He'll be one of your new favorite KingCast guests, guaranteed.
Yeah.
This Friday on our Patreon, you know, we have a Patreon bonus episode every Friday. We are talking to two of the founders of KingCon, which is going to be the biggest Stephen King convention that's going on. We kind of wanted to have them on to talk about like what it's like building up one of these things. It's a giant show in Vegas. It's happening this October at the Link Hotel. It's going to be like a bunch of Stephen King artists, a bunch of Stephen King actors and whatnot. They're all kind of gathering in one spot to celebrate all things Stephen King from the collecting side of things. Who else might be there? I don't know. There might be an interesting surprise. There might be some podcasts that end up at KingCon this October. And if you want to hear more, well, sign up to our Patreon, babies. That's patreon.com/thekingcast. We will be talking about that, our potential involvement in this endeavor, and lots more. So, yeah, head on over, throw us a few bucks, and you'll get all that info this Friday, as well as access to all of the stuff that we've done over the last damn near or over 4 years now at this point, on the Patreon. So that's hundreds and hundreds of hours of us mindlessly talking. I'm not going to say mindless. There's some minds in there.
It's mostly
but every
mindless.
Once in a while, there's a mindless episode.
But
it's if you're listening to the main feed and you love the main feed and you want more, well, you're only really getting half of what we're putting out. So head on over to Patreon, give us a few bucks, and we'll make it worth your while.
Absolutely. And thank you for listening, folks. Adios.
Bye. The KingCast is a Fangoria podcast production. The show is produced, hosted, and created by Eric Vespi, that's me, and Scott Wampler. Tiara Ansley and Abhi Goel are executive producers. Daniel Danger is our art director, and editing is done by yours truly.